So we are in the closing chapters of the book of Revelation we've been going through for the last several months. This book, Revelation, the unveiling, the apocalypse. It's a book about how God is showing us what else is going on. We can see with our own physical eyes what's going on in the world around us. And sometimes we see good, sometimes we see bad, and we see these struggles and we wonder what's going on. Revelation is a book that shows us what's going on behind the scenes. It reminds us that in the midst of the challenges, in the midst of persecution, that there is a God who is on the throne. It reminds us in the midst of those all these things that we see with our physical eyes, that there's a spiritual battle going on. But that in the midst of all those things, that God is with us and God is doing things and God is working his justice. And the final chapters show us what that final sense of justice looks like. So while the first 20 chapters are mostly showing the past, we're beginning in the last few chapters, we see the final judgment of the powers of evil, of Babylon, of the beasts, and then of the Satan. And then finally, we see now in Revelation 21 and 22, these visions of hope, of a new heaven and a new earth, that God is making all things new. And this is our hope. And so we're going to do this a little bit next week more on how we live today. And then in the final week, we'll kind of do the end credits, the last little bit of chapter 22. So last week we looked at this picture of a new heavens and a new earth. And one of the things I wanted to emphasize is when God makes all things new, it will be a physical experience. It's not simply a spiritual going away, but God will renew heaven and earth and we'll have this embodied experience and living in a physical world. And this week I want to look at this image of new creation and our greatest joy and where God is taking history. Where is God taking history? And I want to do it through some of the images that John uses to describe this new heaven and the new earth. And he has a lot of different images that he uses. He kind of mixes things up. He's got a bride, and then he's got a city, and he's got a garden, and he's got a temple, and all these different things together. And I want to explore three of those. The garden, the city, and the temple. And kind of how those images go together. We're going to look at what John describes here briefly. Then kind of think about them in the story of the big story of the Bible. And the reason to do that is Revelation is not by accident the last book of the Bible. It's the book that kind of shows us the conclusion of the whole story. And while the Bible is in some sense a bunch of separate books, it also tells a grand story. It begins with God creating all that there is, seen and unseen, in the first chapters of the Bible. The first pages of the Bible is God creating everything. And then what's the final chapters? God making all those things new. And in the midst of it is all the process, all the mess that we make and the way God is working to save that, particularly through his son, Jesus. And so we're going to connect those together. So the first image I want us to look at briefly is the image of a city. And we didn't read that passage. There's a lot to do here. And so I kind of had Susan skip over some of it. But in chapter 21, verse 10, this is what John says. He says, "And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain, great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God." And so the first picture that God describes through John of the new heaven and the new earth is a city coming down out of the sky, which is not necessarily how we think of the final thing we think of heaven, but it's a giant city coming out of the sky, and it's this description of what it looks like. And this is all in 21, like verses 10 and following. And it says, "It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal." And so there's this brilliance, this shining place in jasper we saw earlier describing God's throne. And then it goes on and it describes that there's 12 gates in the city, and the city has 12 foundations. And if you've been here for any part of the series, one of the things we emphasize, when you hear numbers, you think symbols, right? They stand for something. What do they weigh? What do they signify? And John tells us right there, in some sense, he said, "And the gates were written in the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And then the 12 foundations were the 12 apostles." And so we get these pictures say, this city has these gates that represent the tribes of Israel, the people of God in the Old Testament. And then the city has foundations, which are the 12 apostles, the city, the people of God in the New Testament. So in other words, what do we see? We see a city that's connected with what? The people of God. And in some sense, it's almost like the city is the people of God, but we see a city coming down with them and God's story with them. And then we have an angel in verse 15. An angel who talked with me had a measuring rod in his hand to measure the city, its gates, and its walls. And actually, earlier in the book of Revelation, we had the same thing. An angel with a measuring rod. These angels seem to like their measuring tapes, measuring rods, and like to measure things. It's not the first time. It happens back in the book of Ezekiel, where there's an angel who comes and there's a temple and the angel measures it. Is it just to give us dimensions? I don't think it's just to give us dimensions. The whole point is, when you're measuring something, it's a symbol of security. It's a symbol of protection. It's a symbol of presence. And all these things go together. And so here's this angel measuring and saying, oh, that's what's happening. Is God measuring it as a way to say, kind of like, this belongs to me. And then we have a very strange city. Because as he measured the city and found it to be 12,000 stadia in length and as wide and high as it is long. So if you remember basic geometry, if you have something that's same width, length, and height, what do we call that? A cube, right? And so we have a giant city cube. That's this huge thing, 12,000 stadia, which is about 1,500, 1,600 miles. So, I mean, we're talking, that's a big city. I mean, it covers essentially almost the whole Mediterranean world. If you were to drop it down, it would cover from basically Jerusalem almost to the far western coast of Spain. And so it's, in some sense, about the same size as the Roman Empire. I don't think that's what John had in mind. But it's this huge, giant cube. But again, 12,000. We hear that number 12 again. 12 and 12 times 1,000 and 1,000 being 10 times 10. And so there's this number, this symbol of completeness. In fact, the angel measures the wall and it's 144 cubits. 144 is 12 times 12. And so there's these pictures of what the city looks like. And I don't think we're meant to envision a giant cube coming out of the sky. But instead, a picture of what God is doing is this symbol of completeness, because it's the story of the Old Testament. It's the story of the New Testament, the tribes of Israel and the apostles. And it's this thing that's complete. It's 12,000. And then it has jewels in it. It says that, so the first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth ruby, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, ninth topaz, turquoise, jacinth, amethyst. And that's verse 19 and 20. It's all these things. And some of those actually are really hard. They're not sure what jewels they transport. But there's another place in the Bible where something is made with 12 jewels. And it's the breastplate that the priests of the Old Testament wore. In fact, many of the same, it's about 8 or 9 of the same jewels match up. And again, because of the languages, probably we have the same 12 jewels. And so we're getting this picture of this connection between the city and what's going on there. All right, so real quick, we have a city coming down. The city represents, it shines. I mean, this is a nice city. I mean, you get the impression. I mean, there aren't rundown sections. What I mean, it's shining with brilliance. You have streets of pure gold, pure as glass. I don't even know what does that look like? Like glass, gold that's so pure it's like glass. It's this city that shines with the glory of God, and it's connected to God's people. So that's the first image we want to keep in our mind. So whatever John is describing of this new creation, he's using the image of a city and its connection with God's people and with the glory of God. The next image is a temple, which you might want to say, wait a minute, I just heard her read and she said, I did not see a temple in the city. So now Pastor Carl's saying the image is a temple. So what am I getting at here? That's verse 21, or chapter 21, verse 22. I did not see a temple in the city because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. And so you think, wait a minute. Is there a temple or is there not a temple? Because I don't see a temple, but God is its temple and God is there. So what do we mean by God is the temple? What is the Lamb is the temple? So what was the purpose of the temple? It was the place of God. And so if we envision kind of two big circles, and not as literal circles, but we have heaven as one, which is God's space, and the other big circle is earth, which is people's space. The intersection between those two is where God is. And so the temple was a way for the people to experience God on earth. It was to say, this was the place where God dwells on earth. Now we have an understanding, basically, that yes, God is everywhere. But it was the special place that represented God's dwelling place on earth, which is why the city of Jerusalem, which was where the temple was built, was so significant to the people of God. So this temple is the intersection of these two things. And so we see that here we have, and why is there no need for the temple? Because heaven and earth have come together and God is everywhere. God is present. And so there's no need for a temple. All right. Back to the temple. One other connection with the temple. What did I say the shape of the city was? A cube. There's one other piece of architecture in all of the Bible that is also a cube. The Holy of Holies, which was when they built the temple, they built it and there were all these elaborate things, but at the center of it, what was called the Holy of Holies, which was a cube, and inside it sat the Ark of the Covenant, and that was the place where God's presence was. And so we begin to see, oh, all these connections, all these pictures coming together. And also, what else was significant about the temple? When you went into the temple, did you just kind of walk into the temple without doing anything? No, there were preparations. There was washing to go in. And there were certain things that were not allowed in the temple. Symbols of death, symbols of impurity. Well, what do we have here? We have a place where there is no death, where there is no mourning, where all that is evil, where it says, you know, certain people, certain actions are not allowed in it. So we have a picture, we have a city and we have a temple. Third image we want to look at, a garden. So this is down in verse chapter 22. It says, then the angel showed me the river of the water of life as clear as crystal flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. So there's a river flowing down the center, which is exactly what was in another garden in the Bible. Chapter 2 of Genesis, there's a garden. And so if you're wondering, there's a lot of verses. A lot of these verses are referenced in the insert in your bulletin here, but that's in Genesis 2:10, which says, a river watering the garden flowed from Eden, and from there it's separated. So there's a garden, there's a river flowing down the center. And then it says, down the middle of the great street of the city, this is where the river's flowing. And on each side of the river stood the tree of life. Well, we saw the tree of life in one other place in the Bible, the Garden of Eden. Back in Genesis 2:8. So, I know we're kind of moving fast through this, but we're going to see, we're going to kind of cycle through it. So we have three images that John is using to describe the new heaven and the new earth. First, it's a city. Second, it's a temple. Third, it's a garden. And so now what I'm going to do is I want to take those three images and kind of we're going to go in reverse order. So we're going to go garden, temple, city, and kind of briefly think about them in the context of the Bible, in the big story of the Bible. Now, I'm going to go kind of quickly through this. You might not get all the details. You might not remember all the stories. But again, that's why I've tried to reference some of them here. But I want you to try and make sense of this big story of the Bible. And so the garden, I've already hinted at, alluded to that. The garden, we first see a garden on the opening pages of the Bible. That God creates the heavens and the earth, and there's this sense of a garden. This is where God puts people. But there's something significant about the garden, because in Genesis 3:8, this is after Adam and Eve have chosen to not listen to God. There's a description that says, then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden. So what else is in the garden? We have a river in the garden. We have the tree of life in the garden. What else is in the garden? God. God is physically present. I mean, they hear him walking. That somehow God is physically present with them there in the garden. But then Adam and Eve choose to go their own way, as all people do. They choose to decide for themselves what's right and wrong. And they're put out of the garden, which means they have no access to the tree of life. They have no access to the river. But what else are now they cut off from? The physical presence of God. And through the rest of the Bible, people encounter God, but it's always mediated. There's always something in between. There's a prophet speaking. There's a bush speaking. There's a voice. Nowhere else in the Bible do people encounter directly the presence of God. It's always in some image, but not in the sense of God walking with them in the garden. So we have that picture of here what's going on. But Eden, here we go. Eden is more than a garden. It's a temple. And this could be a whole sermon series on how Eden is a temple. But just a few clues. All right. Remember, what was the function of the temple? The temple is the place where God dwells. And so we have a creation story. God creates everything. And at the end, the seventh day, what does God do? He rests. He sits down. That's exactly what happened when in the ancient Near East, they built a temple. There was a whole description building the temple. And at the very end, the God is placed in the temple. Well, God himself puts himself in the temple. All right. A couple other things we want to look at. The language of cultivate. The people, Adam and Eve, are called in Genesis 2:15. They're called, it says, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. Those two particular words, every time they occur together through the Old Testament, they're used for one of two things. One is to describe either keeping God's word or the work of the temple priests. That's the only time those words occur together, is the work of the temple priests. The other thing, and I know you all are up on temple architecture, right? I mean, how many of you, Leviticus and Deuteronomy, like favorite books of the Bible, right? One of the things that Leviticus and Deuteronomy describe are the construction of the temple and of the tabernacle, of all those things going on. And also like First and Second Kings, other top favorites of people reading through the books, right? Of like all these names. But if you read the descriptions of the temple and the decorations in the temple, what do you think are the primary decorations inside the temple? What sort of, they craft things out of gold and out of wood. What sort of things decorate the entire temple? Fruits and trees. Well, where else do we see fruits? I mean, so the temple itself is a picture. You go into this elaborate temple, which is gold covered, but everything is plums and pears and trees and fruit. It's a picture. It's a reminder that this place, in some sense, is a representation of Eden. All right, so we have the garden as this first image in the Bible that comes up. But then we have the temple, which I've said is kind of decorated like a garden. So the idea of the temple comes along. So early on in the story of the people of God, they're in slavery in Egypt. They're brought out of slavery in Egypt and they're traveling through the desert. And they want to know that God is with them. God gives them plans to build a tabernacle. Tabernacle is a fancy word for a tent. And the tent is a portable temple. It's a place where they go along and they take this everywhere. And it represents what is the temple and tabernacle again? The presence of God. So when they're walking and they're getting ready in the book of Numbers, it describes them and they've got the tabernacle at the center and they've got the tribes all around it, that the presence of God is at the center of where they go. So they have this tabernacle that goes in, and at the center of the tabernacle is this Holy of Holies. But the Holy of Holies is a place where only a few people can go. So we have this image of a temple and a tabernacle and all along, and then eventually Solomon builds this huge temple, the one in Jerusalem, in this massive temple. But then Jesus comes along, and there's still a temple, there's still a physical temple in Jerusalem where the people come and represents the presence of God. But Jesus does something that Jesus likes to do. He stirs the pot a little bit. He flips things around. So John, probably the same John who wrote Revelation, John who wrote the Gospel of John, says in John chapter 1, verse 14, it says, the Word, he's describing Jesus, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And we could translate that really as Jesus tabernacled, or he pitched his tent. And so John is already hinting at when Jesus comes, he represents that. And actually John uses this, or Jesus uses very specific language in John chapter 2. Jesus answers them, destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. But the temple he had spoken of was his body. So what is Jesus telling us when he's saying, I am the temple? He's saying, I am the presence of God. I am the presence of God here on earth. And so we begin to see that picture. So we've got a garden and this image of the temple, the tabernacle becomes a temple, becomes Jesus as the representation of the presence of God. All right, so we've got a garden, which is the beginning where God is present, but then the people are cut off, and so God provides them a tabernacle or a temple. And there they can encounter God, but only on certain days, and only certain people can go in. And then Jesus comes along, and he says, I am the tabernacle, I am the temple. But again, everybody has limited access. Only certain people can encounter. We can't encounter the physical Jesus right now. What was our third image? A city. City in a Bible is kind of a mixed bag. So, story of the Bible. People of God, they leave the garden, and one of them is a man named Cain, and Cain was the one who killed his brother. And Cain goes out, and what does he do? He builds a city. Which we're not told if that's bad or good, but it turns out to be kind of bad. And then later on, the people of God build Babel, another city to try and to reach to God. And most of the way through the Bible, city is kind of a mixed bag. I mean, we have the city of God, which is Jerusalem, but even Jerusalem isn't the greatest place. Jesus comes in his final days and he weeps over Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is also the place where Jesus is crucified. And then all through the book of Revelation, we've heard about another city called Babylon, a symbol of, and even if you don't remember the whole series, will we say Babylon good or Babylon bad? Bad. If you say good, then I've got to start over again because we've, and I know nobody wants that. So Babylon is bad. And so generally we have a picture of like cities aren't a good thing. I mean, most of the way through the Bible, cities aren't a good thing. So let's put those all together. We have the beginning of the story of the Bible begins with people in God's presence in a garden. They're put out of the garden. They're cut off from the presence of God. And so now they can experience the presence of God where in a temple or in a tabernacle, but only on a limited basis. And then we have Jesus who comes as the mediator and we have access to God. And even thus, we have access to God through prayer, but it's still not like what it was in the beginning where we have access to the physical presence of God. And then we also have this strange in this image of the city, which kind of seems an outlier, a place of rebellion. So if you're thinking like, okay, I've got this story of the Bible. It begins in this garden. It begins in, what do we often call Eden? What's another word that we often use to describe Eden? Paradise. And so now if you're thinking the end of the Bible, the end of the story of the Bible, and it began in paradise, what do you expect to return to? Paradise. Which you would expect is the beginning of the Bible described it as a garden. So in my thinking, well, if we began with a garden, which was paradise, and God is making all things new, aren't we going to return to paradise in a garden? That's what I would think. But what did we say that it looks like? A cube, a giant city. So we get a garden city temple. It's kind of like this long hyphenated word. And does anybody here speak German? And German is a strange language. And what they do is they tend to like mash words together to make really, really long words. And so this is kind of what, and so I'm doing that here. So we have a garden city temple. And just kind of imagine that as one word, garden city temple. And so this is what's happening here. But they're all connected by a theme. The garden, the city, and the temple. And the key verse that I want us to pay attention to is Revelation 21:4. This says, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying. That's all right. That's not the verse I wanted. Hang on. Yeah, just a minute. Hang on, let me get back to my... I want verse 3 is what the one I want. So, sorry, verse 21:3, which says this. He says, and I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people and he will dwell with them. They will be his people and God himself will be with them and be their God. And so one of the things, oftentimes we think about the new heaven, the new earth. So 21:3, it says, when we often think about the new heaven, the new earth, we get focused on a lot of things. And it's like, well, what's it going to be like there? You know, what's my body going to look like? What are we going to be doing? That's one of the great questions. What are we going to be doing for all of eternity? Good question. We also maybe have a question about who are we going to see? You know, what's it going to be like as we experience maybe family, friends, people who've gone before us? And those are all important things and all good questions to ask. But there's more than seeing family and friends. That's part of it. But the focus is that we will be with God. And God will be with us. Then it's back to the garden, back to the reason for the tabernacle and the temple. that the beginning of creation, when God created it, he designed it so that we could be with him. And the rest of the story of the Bible is after we've left God, is God working to bring us back to be with him. That's the garden, that's the temple. And what about the city? Well, I think what the city is doing, the reason for the city is it's showing how God redeems and fulfills things. Because in that beginning, I'm not sure that we were meant to just stay in the garden. It describes the people of God, and God tells Adam and Eve they're to subdue the earth, they're to grow and to multiply. In other words, they're to go out and do things. They're to go out and to be sub-creators. God was a creator, and they're out to go out and do things. And we see that in the Bible when God calls people, and they're called, and they make wonderful crafts and jewelry and amazing decorations, and they're called to do things. So Richard Bauckham says it this way. He says, in the New Jerusalem, the blessings of paradise will be restored. But the New Jerusalem is more than paradise regained. As a city, it fulfills humanity's desire to build out of nature a human place of human culture and community. But the key idea is this, that he will be our God and we will be his people. And that runs through the Bible. And so I put a whole bunch of verses. I'm going to read off a handful of verses from the insert here. This is Genesis 17:8. The whole land of Canaan where you now reside as a foreigner, I will give as an everlasting possession to you and to your descendants after you, and I will be their God. Leviticus 26:12, I will walk among you and be your God, and you will be my people. Jeremiah 24:7, I will give them a heart to know me that I am the Lord. They will be my people, and I will be their God. Jeremiah 31, this is the covenant I will make with the land of Israel after that time. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people. Or Ezekiel 11. Then they will follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. They will be my people and I will be their God. This is one of the consistent promises. And now we have it here in the book of Revelation. And likewise, we have another one. The idea of God with us. And it's the same sort of language. I will be their God and they will be my people. Or God will be with us. Which we see ultimately fulfilled in some sense in Jesus, who goes by the name Emmanuel, which means God with us. And so all those things are there. So I want to try and bring all those things together. I know we've kind of been moving around a lot of different things, but three images, garden, city, temple. But in the midst of all those, the primary thing is what? The presence of God. That is where all of this is leading to, all of the things are going to, all of the history, all of what God is doing is ultimately restoring a place where we will be with him fully in his presence. So first idea I want to point to is where God is taking history includes a city. Now I know some of us don't like cities very much. In fact, a lot of us moved out here to Fruitland Township because we don't like cities. And then you're thinking, really? That's what eternity is going to be like, a city? But we have to remember, this was written in the first century. And it's a symbol, it's a picture. And when John is describing a city, he's picturing a city because a city represents something that's implied by the city. And that's life together, it's commerce, it's the arts, it's all those things. Now, certainly those happen in a small town. But the picture, the idea behind saying it's a city is we're together as people. In other words, where God is leading us to isn't a thing where we all get to go off and live in our little own cabin for all eternity, but instead we're with other people and we're creating and we're doing all sorts of amazing things. I think I asked the question earlier, what are we going to be doing for all of eternity? I don't know, but I think one of the things we're going to be doing is we're going to be creating and making things. I think there will still be poems written. There will still be songs to be sung. There'll be pictures to be drawn. We'll be able to build, to create all sorts of amazing things. Now, I don't know that for sure. I don't know, but that's my guess, is because that's what we were designed to do in the first place. But the difference will be that when we make things, they won't be flawed by sin. I mean, we were called to fill the earth, to create, to build, and to wonder. And so one of the things Michael Gorman points out as we think about this, he says, this tells us that it is not civilization or culture, the city itself, that is evil. The fact that we have a city says the city itself isn't evil, but the distortion of civilization, culture, and the city caused by evil people and powers. In other words, what we see around us is a distortion. We speak of culture. Sometimes in the church, we just use culture as like code word for bad. Culture is just the way we live. It's who we are and what we do. And it will be fully redeemed in the end. But in the meantime, we're called now to participate in the renewal of culture. That's one of our calls as a Christian, to participate in the renewal of culture now. By speaking out prophetically, by looking at what's going on in the way we live life together and saying, we have a culture which does not value life, and we need to speak out against that. We need to work against that. We have a culture which seems to value greed, and we need to speak out and work against that. We have a culture which seems to focus on bodily image and in the way and certain images that people look, and we need to speak out against that. We have a culture that often wants to divide us into little tribes and separate us out, and we need to speak out against that and to work against that. That's the path that God is leading us to, and we're called to live out that. So when God says the new creation will be a city in which all these things are going on, he's calling us to live into it now and to redeem the culture and the creation we live in. That's the first thing. Second thing, kind of implication. If the goal of the story, where it's all leading to, is life with God, that's kind of what I've tried to get to, is this picture of the garden and of the temple is all about living in the presence of God, that the goal of life is life with God, then part of it means that we need to live that way now as best we can. And so I like kind of a picture, Sky Gittani, an author, he kind of puts it in a couple ways. He says, oftentimes we distort our relationship with God. He lists four different ways that we think about God. Sometimes we think about life under God. And life under God means if we do the right things, God will reward us. You know, if we just do, you know, if I do all the right things, God is going to reward me. That's life under God. It's a focus on behaviors. He also talks about life over God. That's living without God. That's where, like, you don't need God. You know, that's the impression of, God is just superstition. It's supernatural. We don't need that. I'm life over God. You know, God is not necessary. That we can change and control life through science and reason and learning. Third one he talks about, he says, another distorted picture of life is life from God. And that's the idea that God exists simply to supply our needs. That's consumer God, you know, and that's what oftentimes like, if I just, you know, God, I need this. God is like a giant vending machine. And God is just distributing and making sure you live this life. The last one we might think, well, that's not a bad life for God. And that's often a reaction to consumer life. You know, it's like, I'm going to live my life for God. That sounds like a good thing, right? To live your life for God. I mean, we have examples in the Bible of it. Like Paul, he lived his life for God. He gave everything he had and he went and he preached and he taught and he planted churches and he was living his life for God. But even in the midst of that, Paul never let his mission define him. When Paul talked about it, he said the ultimate thing, his ultimate goal was God himself. And so we can live certainly a life for God. And I'm not saying we shouldn't live a life for God, but sometimes we can get so focused on living that life for God. Well, I'm doing all this great stuff for the church and I'm doing these things and I'm reading my Bible and I'm giving to missions and I'm going on a mission trip and I'm teaching Sunday school class. I'm doing all these great things and look at all these great things I'm doing for God. And God says, yeah, I appreciate what you're doing for me, but what I want is you with me. And so this is what he's saying, that life with God, God isn't a means to an end. The goal of life is God, that Christ should be our treasure. And this is what he's getting at here, is that life with God is the goal. And this is what we should see, is the greatest thing about our hope and our joy is that. And that's the final thing, is to remind ourselves of our hope and joy. I mean, I read this picture of the new thing and I think, you know, it says he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. And I think, man, I long for that day. I long for the day when I won't experience the pain that goes on in the world around me. A time where I won't have to go to any more funerals, where I won't have to be with people who are experiencing, where I won't have to suffer that same loss myself of losing a loved one and experiencing death. And wow, what an incredible thing. But what this is saying, or what I'm trying to get, is there's something even more wonderful. And Michael Gorman says it with a bunch of really big words, but he says, eschatological life, in other words, where life is headed, is marked by God's perpetual perceptible presence. like he does a good job, preacher alliteration there, perpetual perceptible presence. In other words, a state of permanent incarnation, so to speak. In other words, that perceptible, I can't even say it, perpetual perceptible presence, the presence of God, that our Creator, that the one who gave us life, the Lamb who died for us, will always be there. I mean, because one of the other things we experience in this life is not only that mourning or sorrow, but sometimes that feeling like we're not sure God is there. I don't know, maybe you don't ever experience that. But I know, no, I know I do. Sometimes like, where's God in the midst of all this? This absence of God, this desire to like, I just want to be. Think about in your own life, if we were to take it down to like the level of, you know, of a loved one. One of the greatest things we do is just what? Spend time with them, right? To just be in their presence. And sometimes we don't even need to do anything. It's just to sit on the porch or to sit on the beach or to sit in the living room and just sit and to be with them. I know for me, and I know for many people, they'll talk about a loved one that's gone and they'll say, I just want to see them. I just want to be with them. And that's what God is saying is the greatest thing is to be with him, is to be with God, to never feel like he's absent, to never feel like he's alone, never feel like he's distant. So John Dyer says it this way. He says, the presence of Emmanuel, whose name means God with us, among his people is our greatest hope. But then he says, the non-mediated God, in other words, where there's no separation between us, physically present with us, will be our greatest joy. And so as we read Revelation here, this is what I want us to hang on to. Is that's our greatest joy. As we think about whatever the new heavens and the new earth will be like, we can't necessarily understand all of what it will look like and how a glass and a giant cube city and river, and there's a tree that's on both sides. How can you have a tree that's on both sides of the river? And there's jewels and gates and foundations. But one thing we can know for certain, even if we don't understand all these things, is that these words of God, he says, God's dwelling place is now among the people and he will dwell with them. They will be his people and God himself will be with them and he will be their God. That we will be in the presence of God. We're in the presence of God now through the Spirit, but it's a limited, it's not quite there. But one day we will see him face to face and always be in his presence. And so let us cling to that as our hope and as our joy. This picture that even if we don't understand all the images and all the pictures, that one day we will be with God, fully in his presence, and he will be with us forever and ever. Amen.